Welcome to the Industrialised podcast, where we speak to those leading the charge towards the future of construction. This week, Darren Richards, Director of Kodrick Consulting, speaks to Ron Lang, Regional Director of Atkins Realis. In this conversation, Ron talks about defining industrialised construction beyond offsite, creating a consistent cross-industry message, and the cultural shift required to broaden the construction audience.
Welcome to the Industrialised podcast. Well, today we're joined by Ron Lang from Atkins Realis. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about the work that you do, Ron, and a bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm a region director at Atkins Realis. I work in the advisory part of the business, so very, very early stage with clients. I have worked in sort of transformation and change in construction for at least the last 15 years or so. And of course, one of the common consistent themes of transformation in our sector has always been around industrialization.
And you're involved very heavily as chair of the Construction Leadership Council's Industrialised Construction Working Group.
Yeah, really proud to represent a group of people that in one way or another I've been working with for a very long time. So that group was very much set up off the back of the Construction Innovation Hub programme, if we remember that, and trying to keep that sort of collaborative spirit alive in the absence of a funded programme. So yeah, we do try and do everything we can to support the industry, support government with its policy agenda. And yeah, really good group of people.
And how is that work of the group influencing either your approach as a consultant at Atkins Realis or more broadly, how is it evolving to influence government and the industry?
Yeah, so I guess there are kind of two aspects to that. One is it's always refreshing. I've always worked in the sort of open collaboration space. So yes, I'm a consultant now, but I haven't always been. So trying to keep some of those collaborative conversations going outside of, you know, usual competition between consultants. It's not just consultants, though. We have supply chain representatives. We do have members of departments and government there, too. What's really useful for me is trying to create consistent messaging. So just me going out for what I've been quite a few years and trying to refine the message around industrialization, trying to refine policy on my own, of course, isn't the way to do things. So what I enjoy about that group is trying to bring together a group of people and come to some agreement on how we communicate this thing, how we articulate what it is we're trying to achieve and collectively try and help clients and government to maybe develop better conditions for industrialization. So the collaboration bit, really, I know it sounds cheesy and people talk about collaboration too much, to be honest, but it is what CLC is about, is trying to create consistent and common kind of articulation of particular issues.
And I know one of the key outputs earlier this year, I think you might have released it end of June or beginning of July, was the definition around industrialised construction, which I think came out of that working group. And no doubt you debated for many hours, several days, no doubt, to try and agree in that group what the definition should be. Are you happy with that, or is that still evolving?
Oh, we're never happy with anything, Darren. yeah, it's the kind of... It's the representation of a conversation that's been evolving for the entirety of my career to some extent, but certainly has accelerated in the last 5 or 6 years. So to try and summarize, I guess, the reason that group, I was very, very passionate about calling that an industrialized construction group, not an MMC or an offsite group. And a lot of that, and we can no doubt get onto that as we go through this conversation, is about trying to move away from the idea that we can force manufacturing into construction and actually helping people to understand that an industrialized approach is an entirely different kind of delivery model for construction. So that has been quite difficult, but the definition document is more of a continuously evolving thing. So I version it, which I think in itself is trying to articulate that it isn't finished. But it has been useful in helping people to understand what industrialization is about. You know, what has been the consistent theme over many decades. And that is about accepting we can't continue to deliver very bespoke assets using very craft labor. How do we become more industrialized in our approach to delivery built assets? So I think it's a good starting point. I think it also does a good job of explaining how other terms like offsite construction, like modular, like platforms fit into that broader piece around industrialization.
And I know we put it out for consultation at the Industrialized Construction Conference this year. There's quite a lot of feedback on it. Has that been taken into account, and are we due to see another revision or evolution of that?
Yeah, so we'll definitely see another evolution. We've been quite quiet over the summer, trying to sort of let people have their holidays and digest some of the stuff we've been doing over the last sort of 12 to 18 months. We're just currently going through that now, trying to refine it. And even between revisions, you know, there are lots of sub versions that I or others create. But I think that's really refreshing. Rather than creating things that are then static for many years, we are creating something that's quite dynamic. So we'll see an update hopefully in due course.
Okay, good. So moving away from the CLC working group activity, may come up again in conversation, but let's talk about the Atkins Realis kind of service model and how you encourage the implementation of industrialized construction practices when you're advising clients. So where does that start? I mean, how does it start? Does it start with defining it?
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting kind of case study for all the stuff that we're talking about. So I joined Atkins Realis about 4 years ago. So for those that don't know, Atkins Realis are a global, they're classified as sort of engineering consultancy. They have been involved in every kind of major project and program that you can imagine. But my journey through that organization is quite representative of the journey that a lot of those consultancies are going on. So I joined originally off the back of the Construction Innovation Hub program. I joined the sort of design team element of Atkins Realis. And what that means is that you are part of the part of construction that receives something that is already kind of too late for industrialization. It's quite difficult to articulate, but if you work in design, often you're coming in at Rebus Stage 3, for example, you know, you often find that is kind of the problem we're facing. So what's happened, and I guess my journey through that, is moving through the business earlier and earlier and starting, as I said, to work at the sort of client advisory end. So what that means is I'm effectively helping clients to set the right conditions for industrialization. So I work predominantly in sort of major programs of work rather than sort of major infrastructure projects, and trying to advise a client about how they set up a program to be able to deliver it in a more industrialized way. So that has involved things like NEOM, which many people will know, advising on how they industrialize the delivery of what is a significant or giga project, I think, as we call it nowadays. But it also involves clients like Ministry of Justice, who, again, are continuously improving their approach. But how do they move when they look across a portfolio of the 20K or 20,000 prison place program that they've got? You know, how do they make that more industrialized in its delivery? So I guess what I'm trying to summarize is that trying to get clients to ask the right questions of consultants is the bit where I sit. There's then an internal challenge about how I make sure my business is ready to respond when it's asked a slightly different question. So that starts the challenge. And again, this is not just about Atkins Realis, this is about all kind of consultancy organizations. You know, how do we start to move away from being paid to reinvent things? How do we start to move towards industrialized design? And that means that maybe we're working a much earlier stage to produce designs and systems that can be used repeatedly. That starts to really challenge, for most of the existing consultancies, the business model that we rely on. So we need to move away from, you know, paying for days of engineers and designers' time to move in towards the design of kind of repeatable systems and processes. That is a huge kind of culture shock for the sector. But it's interesting for me to have worked on both sides of those fences. And originally, of course, you may not know, but I originally came from a design background. So having the appreciation of how it's done now and then trying to reshape it at the front end is really interesting.
And are you finding clients receptive to this now, that there's maybe just, you know, a key imperative, you know, they've got to do it, it's not a desire, you know, it's a necessity now to address, whether it's low carbon or skills issues? You know, it's not up for debate, really. It's about you've got to get on and find some way of getting onto the industrialized construction ladder.
So yes and no. I think for government clients, there is increasing pressure from a number of angles. So first of all, the long and short of it is we have less money to deliver more. How do we get more efficiency out of the cash that we have available? So for departments, there's some really encouraging progress across the departments that I've mentioned, Ministry of Justice, Department for Education, Defence Infrastructure Organisation on the MOD side, and of course in healthcare as well, where they realise that unless they start to take a more kind of programmatic, more industrialised approach, they simply can't deliver all the infrastructure that we need. There's an additional angle which comes up, and we maybe get onto the 10-year infrastructure strategy. There is a recognition inside government that we can't have departments competing with each other for skills and capacity. So a move towards, again, a more kind of portfolio programmatic approach across government is really interesting. But I think the flip side to that is when you're trying to sell it to a wider client base, we still don't really have the evidence base to be able to offer this as something valuable to sort of non-government clients. So a lot of my job is about trying to move clients from, you know, these are repeat capital portfolio clients that still deliver in a very project by project way. And that's the way the industry is set up to respond. When you start to have very scary conversations about how they manage capital portfolios and how they might batch things up and take more programmatic approaches, that is a big step. And we start to run into really interesting but quite challenging conversations around, you know, they're making decisions much earlier and they're making decisions outside of the project environment. Now, when cash and capital typically flows through projects, how do you start to create an environment where they can invest in the creation of industrialized approaches outside of projects? It changes their entire kind of procurement model. So I think, in summary, government departments are very receptive to this because they have no choice. I think more widely, though, we need to use that as an example of what, you know, how we can succeed. And we're a little way from that yet, but I think we're seeing really good examples and data come out of programs like the Ministry of Justice New Prisons Program that we can start to use to kind of spread the word in a little bit more of a convincing way.
And are we seeing more verified data being captured now, better metrics to help with that argument?
Again, it's like diplomatic yes and no. I think if we sort of pick up on the prisons program at the moment, the contractors within that alliance are doing a really good job of collecting data to show that it works, you know, to prove to themselves that it works, but also to prove back to government. I think there is still a lot more to be done on the government side to collect consistent data. And I think it's, you know, it's one of the biggest problems. Even if you put industrialization aside for a moment, I still don't feel government has a really good handle on the performance of its projects and collecting consistent kind of performance data from projects. If we did have that, and particularly if we were collecting data around the actual outcomes we want, so, you know, are we driving carbon down? Are we creating sustainable jobs? Is it quicker? Is it more efficient? We could start to build a much better case, but I think it is relying on certain individuals, certain clients, certain bits of the supply chain to collect that data, which often isn't really kind of cross-compatible, if you like, with other data sets. So more to be done, I think, in that space, Darren.
Do you think government might mandate data capture and reporting transparency, you know, into the public domain in the contract terms, maybe moving forward? Is that perhaps the only way we're going to get the data that we want?
I think it is. And again, I think there are two levels to this. So are individual government clients requesting data and putting into their contracts? Yes, I think they are. But of course, that introduces the possibility that different parts of the government machine are collecting different data sets. I think one of the disappointments over recent years has been, you know, we had the whole kind of BIM agenda and mandate, as was, that started to morph into an information management agenda, rightly so, because, you know, BIM was often sort of tainted with the idea that it was just a model. But moving towards a sort of information management mandate, again, that all sort of fell away in recent years. And I think that was the opportunity to have a much better handle on the information and data we collect from projects. So again, I think there is a piece of work there. You know, we have NEMA, who formed recently off the back of that agenda to try and drive that. But it needs to be really at the forefront of what government are trying to do and what it's trying to drive.
Yes, and that data capture has got to go right the way down the supply chain as well to the manufacturers that are producing in the factories 200 miles away, isn't it? You know, it's a complete data set that we're looking for, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that means you're relying on different parts of the supply chain to collect different parts of data. So certainly having clear roles and responsibilities around who needs to collect what would be good. But I think we have to start at the top. So my involvement in things like the Value Toolkit project, which you remember from the Construction Innovation Hub, we're all about starting with the outcomes and impacts we want to achieve. And then you work through the data set you would need to kind of not only understand whether that is happening, but why it's happening. So we have lots of debates and perhaps not one we want to get into today around things like pre-manufactured value as an example, is a proxy that we use for sort of industrialization. It's driving behaviors that aren't necessarily actually reaching the outcomes that we want. So unless you've got a full kind of theory of change thread from, you know, the inputs and outputs that you want through to the outcomes and the impacts that we need, that sort of data set and the KPIs that support it needs to be, as you say, an end-to-end thing, rather than quite isolated metrics that we have at the moment. So it is for sure a huge piece of work. it's a little bit, I guess it's a little bit frustrating that if I put my sort of firm industry hat on, there have been lots of initiatives looking at how we can collect consistent data in the industry, where they try and sort of get maybe policy or public sector buy-in. We then have flashes of time where government feel they're going to take that on and actually drive it themselves. So some people might remember the government construction metrics kind of conversation around transforming infrastructure performance, all the acronyms, Darren. That meant that the industry sort of stepped back for a minute and waited for government to actually come to a conclusion itself about what it wanted to collect. As that then starts to disappear, you suddenly then see all of these private kind of initiatives pop up again, where the industry tries to fill the gap. So I think certainly over my career, and I'm not quite as old as I look, but we've seen cyclically government saying they're going to lead on the metrics, then not doing it. So the industry steps in, then government steps back in again, so the industry stops. You know, we need to kind of break that cycle a little bit and see some leadership, I think, from government. After all, it is our single biggest client. You know, government buys the most construction stuff and projects of anybody. So it should be clearer on what it wants from the market and what performance it expects from the market.
And I guess rather than each of the vertical markets, you know, collecting data in a way they want to, you probably need something like the ONS or somebody that's kind of independent of the sector to mandate how to collect the data and how to present the data. But my experience of government is it doesn't really think like that.
Yeah, it's a fair observation, I think, from my kind of experience, I guess. But the level of granularity in the data is a bit of a problem. We've had conversations in the past with ONS around, you know, why can we not separate out, for example, what do we spend on social infrastructure? I know when we were running the Construction Innovation Hub program, we had this figure of sort of 10 to 15 billion a year spent on social infrastructure. Now, 10 to 15 billion is quite a big range, I think we can agree. There isn't the data actually behind for what we actually spend, purely because things like they haven't defined what they actually mean by social infrastructure. So there is a huge amount of work to be done, and I'm not a data and information expert by any means, but we all know that any kind of change and transformation requires a good base of where you are now. We have to know where we are now to know where we're trying to get to. So I agree. I think ONS have a part to play in being much more prescriptive about what these data sets look like, to give us a solid base to work from.
Okay. So let's move on to what you see as the biggest challenge then to integrating industrialized construction, either within buildings or within infrastructure. I know you could spend an hour talking about all the challenges, but what are the big nuggets that you feel need to be addressed for the whole opportunity of industrialized construction to really open up?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've rightly pointed out this. You know, pointing out one problem is quite difficult. However, there is a consistent theme in a lot of the conversations I have at the moment. So we consistently hear this, the market saying we need pipeline. And the government therefore publishes pipelines. We've just obviously had a new pipeline tool published by government. But there's a slightly different nuance to it. So there's a conversation that I've been having with quite a lot of the government clients recently around how do you actually create longer term, more stable relationships with the supply chain? How do you, you know, make sure that there's some confidence to invest in more industrialized approaches? Now, the answer you will often get around aggregation and continuity from the client side is that we use frameworks. Now, often frameworks, yes, are a route to kind of narrowing down the suppliers you want to work with and a quicker route to market. But there's a big difference between a framework where you are guaranteed batches of work and frameworks where you are simply a route to supplying into individual projects. So I think one of the bigger themes we're going to see, and this is alluded to in the 10-year infrastructure strategy, is how do departments start to move towards these longer term contracting relationships with the market? One of the spaces I'm really interested in is, you know, why do we wait until it's an individual project often before we have a conversation with the market? How is it that we don't show them the portfolio of things that the government needs to deliver and actually pay the supply chain to come up with solutions? So I think coming up with industrialized delivery models should be something you pay for and then you execute. But again, if all the money flows through those individual projects, it's very difficult to see how we're going to create those types of responses. So I think for me, the biggest challenge at the moment is we spend billions every year. Let's just take buildings as an example. As government, we spend billions a year buying buildings every, from the market. How is it that we're still effectively not able to give any kind of certainty? Now, you can get into all sorts of debates around, you know, the political system and five-year cycles and all that kind of stuff. And that definitely is part of it. But I think the positive is we are starting to see government clients move towards, you know, batching of projects. So if we look at, again, MOJ, DfE have done some work in that space, where you can genuinely take a chunk of a pipeline and give it to a tied supply chain to say, how would you deliver this as efficiently as possible? And that's where the outcomes bit comes in. Now, as soon as you start to ask that sort of question, the logical answer is that you would industrialize something. If you give an alliance 20 or 30 schools to deliver, and they know they are going to deliver those, they can start to build those longer term supply chains to deliver it more efficiently. So for me, that's the biggest challenge is around contracting models and how we get away from this sort of project by project procurement approach.
And I think you touched upon MOD, MOJ, DfE, etc. But new hospital program seems to be doing some very interesting work around demonstrating their pipeline and looking at, you know, various policies around standardisation, but also being very transparent on the status of those projects, whether they've got full funding or, you know, they're in for assessment and where they are in their evolution. You know, I think that's quite, to me, that's a pretty smart approach to it. They're the only one I'm aware of that's as transparent around that, but maybe others are doing it. But, you know, some of the work that Emily King is doing within NHP, I think, is quite impressive.
Yeah, I think the NHP is very much a manifestation of a lot of stuff we did in the hub around platform approaches and latterly around industrialized delivery. We tried to move in that direction. In the Construction Leadership Council, people felt it was quite scary. So when we talk about industrialized construction, that's about industrialization of the construction process. Actually, what we're talking about here is industrialization of the entire process of delivering, building products, if you like. And by products, I mean the assets. So NHP is definitely a manifestation of that. We see really good positive responses to all of the principles we set out in the playbook. So can you have a better understanding of your pipeline? As you've just alluded to, they're doing that. Can you aggregate demand and start to drive demand centrally? You know, they're on that journey. Can you rationalize requirements and stop asking the market for a different product every time? Yeah, they're starting to do that. So as you work through the kind of principles that the platform rulebook, as was at the time, set out, they are actually working through a lot of those in a very sensible way. So they're not trying to go too quickly. They're not trying to slow down projects now to industrialize things too quickly, but they're taking stock of the things that would make sense to industrialize now and driving those into projects. So I think it's definitely one to watch. I think it shows a commitment from the government side to invest in that central machine that I was talking about. So, you know, NHP as a delivery vehicle doesn't deliver hospitals. It creates the conditions, it creates the supply chain, it creates the standards and kind of design principles. Yeah, you have to fund that up front. And that, I think that does show some commitment from government in that space that I've said is lacking today.
Very much so. Agree. You touched upon the 10-year infrastructure strategy. I'd like to just kind of talk about that and the role of NISTA, obviously the relatively recently rebranded IPA as was. Now under the leadership of Becky Wood, big announcement, I think, a couple of months back of about $725 billion, I think, over 10 years. You know, that's a pipeline. So how does NISTA grab that opportunity and industrialise the delivery of infrastructure?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, isn't it, that the response from industry is sort of mixed. The 10-year strategy was very much a recognition of what we could do if we took a 10-year kind of view to things. Now, I guess at the time that was being drafted, we, you know, had very strong a government with a very strong mandate, and they were sort of trying to set out what a 10-year term might be able to do for kind of certainty around infrastructure investment. There are a few sub themes that are really interesting to me in there. So one is the recognition, of course, Darren Jones has now moved on to different role in government. He was very, very keen to drive or to recognise that we have had quite a long term approach when it came to what we call economic infrastructure. So the National Infrastructure Commission, which is now part of NISTA, it's been merged with the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, was there to try and advise government from an impartial perspective on longer-term strategy around things like energy and transport and those sort of big infrastructure investments. What we haven't had, though, which was a gap, is long-term thinking around things like education estates or healthcare estates or, you know, the social infrastructure, as they would term it. So within the 10-year infrastructure strategy, and the bit that I guess I've been a bit more involved in through the work that I do, is this social infrastructure roadmap. And it's a recognition of the fact that when we do long-term planning for infrastructure, that has to include hospitals and prisons and schools and all those things that support public services. So I think it's a breath of fresh air to be taking a long-term approach to buildings when previously we kind of only did that with economic infrastructure. The flip side is, you know, can we as a country, can we take long 10-year kind of visions of infrastructure, or does the kind of political process get in the way? And that's a far bigger question than you or I can answer on this call. But I think we have to recognize that the industry takes these things with a pinch of salt. It sees a 10-year pipeline. It sees some commitment to longer-term strategy. And again, within that social infrastructure roadmap part, there is a commitment to try and look at how they can drive those departments towards longer-term contracting arrangements. But, you know, how long is that relevant for? And I think we're a little bit jaded, I guess, by seeing longer-term strategies not implemented. I think the positive side of that, you mentioned Becky Wood. I think Becky is a breath of fresh air into this space. She's come in with great detailed knowledge, not only of kind of construction and engineering, but also with a great understanding of Whitehall and how it works. So if anyone's kind of got the ability to drive through this approach, it's her. And I think just in summary, in terms of how I see NISTA's role, NISTA has to be more than the sum of its parts. So what I mean by that is you bring together the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, who were there to kind of assure and set standards and give some confidence around these big infrastructure investments. You bring that together with the National Infrastructure Commission, whose job it was to be strategic and long-term in its thinking. By putting those two things together, we're expecting a different role for government and NISTA. So what it needs to do, and I guess you can summarise this in kind of three key things. NISTA has to understand the built environment that we have now. So it has to understand the estate and all of the assets that public owns in infrastructure. It has to understand what the needs into the future look like. So for example, if we look at the 10-year health plan, there is a long-term need to move from treating people in hospitals to much earlier care, diagnostics type care. And of course, digitalization of healthcare too. That requires the estate to look very, very different. So in that second space of NISTA, it has to be able to advise government and advise Treasury on what the right things are to invest in, given a long-term shift in the way we want to deliver those services. So we can't simply just keep replacing hospitals and adding hospitals, if actually that's about starting to blend out investment in hospitals and start to blend in investment in community healthcare. They need to be driving that conversation. And then finally, if they understand what we've got now and how it's performing, if they understand what we need into the future, how do we most efficiently deliver that? And that often is the space industrialization sits in, to say, if we can see this huge portfolio, you mentioned this, of 725 billion, is the most efficient way to deliver that departmentally in silos through individual projects? Of course not. How do we start to have a conversation about delivering that pipeline in a more efficient, hopefully a more industrialized way? So I have great faith in the strategy behind the 10-year strategy. We now need to see some action.
Yeah, there's a lot of eye rolling, I think, around big announcements on big long-term strategies, because I think we've all kind of seen it before. And to your point, the relatively short-term 5-year cycle potentially doesn't sit within a 10-year strategy, So I think we're all behind it. We really hope that NISTA and Becky can grab that opportunity and really make it happen, because I think it'd be transformative for the industry, won't it? So moving on to just talking more widely about how we educate, with a little e, the wider industry, the contractors, the stakeholders, clients, etc. Are there good examples that you use from outside of the UK where governments or large contractors can demonstrate that this works? How do you show some parallels to inspire people and say, actually, it really does work. Have some faith, because go to Singapore and look at their industrialized building strategy there. Or do you think, actually, we're so unique in our culture and our approach that those other models don't really hold any water?
It's a very interesting and quite a tricky question in many respects. We in the UK are great at talking a good game, and I can be accused of that, I suppose. So you often find other bits of the world looking at what we do. So the definition document you referenced earlier from the Construction Leadership Council has been, it's been downloaded and used and referenced in all sorts of places across the world as an example of what we're trying to achieve. We're less good at kind of walking the walk, I guess. So that's something we need to work on. When it comes to other examples, I mean, you mentioned the Singapore example. I think it's a good example of what I talked about earlier, which is when you set a really clear outcome. I mean, their drivers are very, very clear. They just don't have the labour. It's a very congested environment. And therefore, when you start to set some targets around labour efficiency, the obvious solution becomes a more industrialised approach. So I think that's a good example of setting the right kind of targets and measures. But it also demonstrates that we can take good examples from across the globe, but generally in different sectors. So housing is often the one that dominates the conversation when we talk about industrialization. And I've written at length about how you know, the housing market in the UK really struggles to adopt industrialization purely for the fact that it's a market-led, kind of private sector-led model. So often we will talk about the Japanese model and these big players like Sekisui and Toyota, but it's a completely different market. So you do have to contextualize these things. I think we're also accused of taking examples from other sectors too often without contextualizing them. So, you know, we've all heard far too many analogies with the car industry, to a lesser extent, the aero industry. And a lot of the work that certainly the Hub did was trying to translate that into the context of construction. So there's no point in banging on about how fantastic car factories are. The product is fundamentally different and the market for that product is fundamentally different. So we did a lot of work around, you know, the platform rulebook was very much trying to translate the model of industrialization that other sectors have into construction and make some sense of it. So I haven't directly answered your question. I think we are accused of being able to explain what we're trying to achieve relatively well, and even creating the tools like the rulebook, for example, as examples of how to do it. We then see other countries take that further and quicker than we do. And I think we need to maybe look inwards and understand why that's the case. I do hope examples like the New Hospitals Programme, like the Ministry of Justice and others that we've mentioned today, you know, do start to shine as great examples of us leading this. But yeah, that remains to be seen.
Yes, and, you know, we need to move at pace, don't we? And we won't get it all right. You've got to make some mistakes along the way, but you've just got to get on and do it, I think. I think for me, the interesting parallels around automotive, aerospace, and some of those other non-construction parallels that we draw is actually not around the technology. For me, it's around the culture that they create. You know, they have a culture of continuous improvement, of lean. You know, we haven't talked about productivity yet, but, you know, productivity in the construction sector is so poor. And where I think we can get inspiration from these other sectors is probably around how to create the culture that enables innovation and change to be adopted quickly, and you know, processes for implementation. And they're very good at that in those other sectors.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the words that comes up a lot that's defined quite differently in different spaces is productization. And I'm not going to try and define it here for that reason, but this idea that all of those sectors we look at and lust after, you know, think about what they produce as products. In the infrastructure and building construction sector, you know, we don't think about buildings as products. We it's just not a kind of mindset that we have. But to industrialize, you have to think about those outputs as products. And I think that mindset shift is the one that's been the most difficult. So in construction, when we say product, people think about a brick or a panel or a beam or whatever else. Clients are reluctant, probably because of the amount these things cost and how you know, long-term they are. It's very difficult to convince a client that they are effectively ordering a product. And when you start to then say, well, actually, you're ordering many, many products, and would the most way to produce any product line be to individually design and manufacture? Of course it wouldn't. So for me, that's the big shift in mindset, is trying to get people to think about certainly parts of the built environment as products, and how we can drive more consistent approaches to the production of those products. It's a huge culture shift, and it's not the way that most people think or are brought into this sector.
No, and it needs, you know, to be discussed and openly debated and understood, because I don't think you can just pick it up and, you know, Xerox copy it into construction and go, just do that. You know, we're going to have to modify and, you know, adapt their models. But I think, you know, we can learn a lot from other sectors. But on the point of educating the market, encouraging the market, creating more collaboration, more communication, etc., you recently joined the Industrialized Construction Advisory Board, which is distinctly separate to the CLC's working group. This is more around communication, this advisory board. I think it's a very important initiative, because the aim of that board is to create platforms, as in communication platforms, to try and get more of this spoken about, just so that the narrative moves on, there's more conversation around it. There are things like the conference, there are webinars, there's a new industrialized construction journal. How do you see them evolving, and, you know, how do we capture some more case studies so we got better content, instead of, you know, people like you and I sitting here and debating it and, you know, kind of looking at the crystal ball gazing? You know, we've got to get more case studies. But, you know, you're quite excited by all that's coming down the track from that advisory board?
Yeah, I definitely am. I think I was delighted to see that movement, if you like, start to manifest into sort of content and communication. So, you know, I think we'd like to draw a closer relationship between the work that CLC group does and what industrialized construction as a movement does, it's a really helpful way of communicating a much broader concept that we've spoken about here. So moving away from showing products and showing systems and sort of asking why we're not using them, to bringing forward examples like the New Hospitals Program to show how it's a much broader conversation, it's a much broader approach. That's tricky because often, you know, people like the shiny stuff they can point at and touch. Trying to make, you know, rationalization of requirements sexy is quite difficult. So I think what's really positive is we are bringing a conversation out through that is much more different to, you know, let's just build things in factories and wouldn't that be fantastic, to a much more intelligent, not to be rude to anybody else, but much more kind of intelligent, holistic conversation. So I am excited. I think you do need that mixed media. Obviously, this is an example that we're doing now. But different, you know, people communicate through different ways and receive things in different ways. So, yeah, really pleased to be a part of it. I think we're going to see that move the conversation on, or help to move that conversation on pretty quickly.
I think one of the biggest challenges for all that initiative, though, is to ensure that we don't have already converted, like-minded people sitting in the room talking to each other. You know, we've got to go and get all the kind of the unconverted, the outsiders somehow, you know, participating in these webinars and conferences and roundtables, so that they begin to become involved in the discussion. And that's quite a challenge, I think, isn't it? You know, how do you, you know, you could probably name 10 people that you see on the same programs over and over again that are industrialized construction experts. But we've got to somehow broaden the club, haven't we?
Yeah, I think it is a challenge. And I increasingly find myself, present company accepted, don't talk to me. No, go and talk to some other people and get a fresh perspective. I think what's probably quite helpful, or what's quite unhelpful, let's take the slightly different angle. What's unhelpful is pitching industrialized construction as versus traditional. I don't find that helpful. I think you alienate people immediately when you do that. What we tried to do with the sort of definition document that you referenced earlier was to explain that no project is 100% traditional, just as no project will ever be 100% industrialized, or sector will ever be 100% industrialized. So we try and say, this is about identifying for a given kind of sub-market which bits of the process should be more industrialized. And that might be, as NHP are showing, some fairly targeted things up front. So, you know, which are the bits that we're really struggling for skills for example, or which bits of the construction process are really, really low in productivity or high in waste or whatever it is. Let's find the examples, the bits of the construction process that really need to be more efficient. And how do we integrate a more industrialized approach to those bits? Now, that requires a really close interface with often a fairly traditional project receiving or integrating a much more industrialized process. And that's the bit that many of us have battled with for years. You know, how do we bring a very productionized process together with a very traditional one? But I do feel quite strongly about that. I think if we keep pitching this as a different thing, that you have to leap from one to the other to make the jump, then I think we've got a problem. If we can increasingly show that shift to the right, and I guess I've got a diagram in my head about moving from a kind of traditional process to a more productionized one as a shift, a spectrum, then we don't lose people so much, because I think, you know, it's human nature to reject something that means that threatens you in some way, that risks your business model. I mentioned that earlier on. You know, consultants are going through a change. We have to move to a slightly different business model. How do we make that a journey rather than a leap of faith, if you like? So I think that's going to be really critical to the comms kind of strategy.
Yes, and I think Mace summarized it very well with the C2P, construction to production, you know, as a journey. You know, that kind of, those three words kind of says, well, that's the journey you're on. You're not going to do it all tomorrow. And, you know, they've got to be complementary. Traditional will always have a role. And hopefully there'll be more industrialized construction to complement, you know, the challenges of traditional, not least the productivity challenges. So which of the influencers in a building's design and procurement do you think we should be engaging with the most? Should it be the client? Is it the tier one contractors or the large contractors? Is it the architects? Do we need to get REBA sitting around the table? Where's the most influence going to come from?
Yeah, so it's a perpetual debate that I have where I point quite a lot at the demand side, because I think if you don't ask a different question, you don't get a different answer. So what we've had for a long, long time is the demand side asking the same question. Please, would you design and build me a very bespoke thing? The answer you get, and the reason the industry has evolved and the roles have evolved as the way they do, is to answer that question. So I do firmly believe we have to get clients to ask a different question. However, there is a valid argument that the sector has to show what it would do if that was the case. So I had a conversation with some peers of mine a couple of weeks ago where I said, you know, we're trying to drive clients and we're trying to drive government and policy into this mindset to drive a more productionized approach. We have to be able to, even if it's hypothetically, show what we would do if that question was asked. So I phrased the kind of problem statement, if you were given this, you know, this huge pipeline of mix of social infrastructure assets, how would the supply chain respond? And this was in a kind of design consultancy context, but we have to show we would be able to answer that different question, because the fear here is that you get clients into a different place, they start to ask a more aggregated, stabilized demand question, and the market sort of turns around and isn't ready. That's a problem. So we do have to bring the things together. Your question was slightly more nuanced in terms of the specific roles. Now, I've mentioned one of them. You know, design has to go from project-based engineer to order towards sort of configuration. That is seen as a threat because it sounds like we're, you know, as consultants losing ground or losing influence. What it actually means is that perhaps our role becomes split. I say our because I still feel like I'm in the design community, but you know, our role becomes split, that we get involved in the design of these kind of repeatable kits of parts and designs. We get involved in sort of platform development as designers, and we also get involved on the project deployment side in configuring those solutions. Now, that's very uncomfortable because that moves us into all sorts of different places we didn't used to play. But the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, the design of those systems and platforms goes somewhere else, and we're left with this configuration task, which doesn't take as much time and therefore we don't make as much money. So I think there's a way some of these things are framed. The tier one model is another example. You know, we spoke a lot about the integrator role when the hub program was around, and there were all sorts of really interesting arguments about, well, who is the integrator, and you know, how does the tier one lose out when suddenly they're not managing all these many interfaces and risks. So I think there is a role for these different players to play, to understand that we shouldn't be threatened by this, but we do have to demonstrate how we would respond should we be asked that question. And I could go on all day about those different role shifts, but I don't think we quite know yet. And it's going to be those organizations that are a little bit braver, a little bit bolder to indicate what that future state looks like. And maybe there's some short-term pain and we have to accept that.
And does it, do you think, make some of those organizations feel slightly insecure, slightly threatened? They don't see it as an opportunity, they see it as a threat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, not to pick on the tier ones, but a good example of that is, you know, clients communicate with tier two onwards through tier ones. So in the rule book we drew, I remember distinctly a peer of mine, Ben Carlisle, drawing a diagram which showed, you know, at the moment, all the communication in a project to the supply chain is through this tier one. So if you suddenly start to lay out this portfolio or program of work, actually, it's quite useful to be able to have a direct conversation with that supply chain who are actually making the stuff. And again, it might be around rationalization of requirements or standardization of the systems themselves. That leaves the tier one sort of jumping up and down the middle to say, but that's my supply chain. You know, a lot of my IP and a lot of my USP is in management, if you want to call it that, of that supply chain. So how do we start to allow a direct conversation? And NHP, of course, are having this direct conversation without kind of upsetting the entire tier one model. So that's a good example where it's seen as a threat, maybe rather than an opportunity.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's clear to me we're on a very exciting journey. Thank you for your time. It's been a real pleasure to discuss your views on industrialized construction, and no doubt we'll be speaking again at some point in the future.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Industrialized Podcast. This podcast was produced by Industrialized Construction Media. The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Industrialized Construction Media. If you enjoyed any of the themes discussed, then the Industrialized Construction Journal is the perfect place to hear more from the experts who are dedicated to the advancement of our construction industry. For more information, head to www.industrializedconstruction.co.uk.